Third Degree. I'm Jess.
And I'm Nick. On the show today, we'll take a closer look at ethical superannuation funds and the results of a survey suggesting Australians want real action on climate issues, regardless of costs.
But first, Renata Field from Friends of the Earth Sydney has just returned from Germany, where she attended the German climate camp and the anti-racist camps, held parallel but with a shared kitchen, in Hamburg at the end of August. Renata, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you going?
Can you tell us why the German climate camp and anti-racist camps were held?
Well, there's obviously a need for action on both those fronts. There's been a few climate camps in Europe, and there's also been a few anti-racist camps, but there's never been one together. And so there were political reasons, but also obviously quite practical reasons that they were held together. For example, you know, you only need one kitchen.
Maybe we are assuming most people know what a climate camp is. Mm-hmm. Could you describe the setup in Germany?
Sure. So climate camp, we also had one in Australia. It's kind of a meeting of people who are interested in climate change and worried about climate change and would like to do something about it. And the setup is like a whole bunch of people camping in a field with a bunch of tents and quite a lot of infrastructure for people to be active. So there's a media tent for people who want to do media, a kitchen for people who want to eat, toilets, all the sort of things you need.
And how many people were there?
Between 1,000 and 1,500 people.
And how significant was Hamburg to the aims of sort of both the climate and the anti-racist groups?
I think they chose Hamburg because it's one of the largest cities in Germany, and so there's a lot of quite active people, and that meant that there were a lot of people to organise it, because organising such a large event can be quite taxing. It's also significant because there's a number of... It's the largest port in Germany, so there's a number of things that happen there, such as genetically modified soy being taken from Brazil and other countries from South America and dumped and burnt for oil, for example.
Hamburg is also the largest coal export port in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there were also... am I right to say that there's a nuclear power station nearby, as well as coal-fired power stations?
Yeah, all that sort of thing. And they're also just about to build, or they're in the process of building a new coal-fired power station. So that was significant. There were a number of protests there during the week.
And what about for the anti-racist camps?
For the anti-racist camps, Hamburg as a particular state was maybe not quite as significant, but it being held in Germany at all is significant because they actually have quite backward laws in terms of migration. They still have, I guess you could call them temporary protection visas, like we used to have, but they mean that people, it's a bit like bail. You have to go to an office every single day to be allowed to stay in the country. Europe's affectionately called Fortress Europe now because it's so hard to get in, and people are really needing to fight against that.
And so is there a big issue with deportations?
Yeah, there's a huge issue around deportations. So on the Friday of the camp, there was a large action at the airport, and that was a joint action from both camps in order to block the airport from running all day. And that was because of the large number of deportations that happened from Hamburg Airport, and also because of the climate issues to do with flying.
Were there any other sort of joint actions that were held aside from the airport?
Yeah, there were a number of joint actions. Another one was against supermarkets. There's a number of chains like Aldi and Lidl and these quite cheap supermarkets, and they're cheap because the produce they sell is produced in a really bad way, which doesn't pay their workers properly, uses illegal workers, and so that was a joint action because of the environmental concerns of the produce that they have, but also the working conditions of the people there.
Can you tell us about some of the other protests? I'm particularly interested in the one where you and other people at the camp convinced locals that nuclear waste would need to be dumped in the middle of Hamburg.
That was a great protest. There was a number of people dressed in like anti-nuke suits, big white suits, and we had really loud machinery, and so it made a really loud noise, and it looked like we were kind of digging and testing and trying to see whether or not this would be a viable area to store nuclear waste. And
so is this like the middle of the road, or
it's like a square in the middle of town? Yeah. And so a lot of people looked, obviously, because it was really loud. And then we were also handing out flyers saying, oh, we're just looking for a space because there's all of the nuclear waste depositories are completely full and we don't know where to put it. And so we're thinking of putting it here. And some people actually believed it. It was crazy.
I'm wondering what you got out of being a part of this as someone mm-hmm. who's been involved in a number of other mass protests. Mm-hmm.
I thought that the intersection between the anti-racist and the climate camps was really interesting. To get people from different movements who are involved in the same struggle together was really interesting, and people could share a lot of stories and a lot of knowledge, and there was I met some really great people who I may not have otherwise met if I was just at an anti-racist camp. And there were heaps of people without papers and heaps of people who'd recently migrated, and it was really interesting to talk with them and to hear their perspectives.
I have a slight radio question, which is about the underground radio that happened throughout the camp. Mm-hmm. What is Hamburg's free radio group?
The free radio in Hamburg happens anyway. It's a collective of people who do radio, which is similar to community radio, but not sponsored by the government, completely separate, independent radio. And they had like a 4-hour slot every day where people could make radio at the camp or on the actions. And that was really integral to the camp in terms of sharing information. Sometimes an action would go late and you didn't know what was happening. Or on the radio, they could be like, hey, this action's been really successful. We need more people. Or people have been arrested there at this prison. Can people go there for solidarity? And also to share those issues with the wider community was really great.
What was the German police's response?
Varied is the answer. It was really weird. Sometimes they did nothing and sometimes they were really full on. I think towards the end of the week they became more violent. On the last day, it was raining really heavily. There were like 300 people standing outside this building site, the construction site of the new coal-fired power plant. And the police were just like, nah, you need to leave, and got out the water cannons and the tear gas and smashed them with batons and everything. But at other actions, they had done nothing, you know, of a similar degree. So it was a little bit weird. A number of people did get arrested, including some people without papers, which was a bit of a shame.
Have you been following the UK Greenpeace case where 6 activists were acquitted of charges related to shutting down the King's North coal-fired power station in Kent last year? And they actually got off using the argument that the contribution this power station makes to climate change is sort of what they would use as a lawful excuse, a justification. Does that give you hope?
Yeah, I think that's awesome. And I think, for example, with our climate change camp, when people were similarly arrested, there's also clauses in Australian law that say, except for extreme need, and I think we need to use that because it is an extreme need.
What was the general sort of vibe of the camp, and was the camp itself actually, you know, sustainable?
It was quite impressive, actually. They had made composting loos for the whole camp. They also had a local farm where they got a large amount of the produce from, and people went and harvested it during the week, and that was really awesome. There was an eco-anarchist barrio neighbourhood area, and they made a wind turbine during the week and also had solar cells, so that was really exciting. And the general vibe, good. Yeah, I think some people were a little disappointed. They would have liked more people, but the actions were really exciting. And it was also really exciting that with 1,500 people, all sorts of things happen and you don't get it all, and then suddenly 2 days later you're like, wow, they blockaded that. That's so exciting.
Thanks for coming in, Renato.
No worries.
And in keeping with the theme of international climate camps, to the UK, home of the world's first camp for climate action, now 3 years ago. They've just had a third camp at King's North coal-fired power station in Kent to highlight the danger of building new coal-fired power stations in the current climate crisis. Campers face major challenges. More than 1,000 police raided the camp, confiscating tent poles and harassing participants. Regardless, they had a record turnout of about 2,500 people through the week, and dozens of protesters scaled fences into the grounds of the power station. Steve Milligan participated in all three camps, and the Third Degree's Libby King caught up with him about how it all began, their aims and principles, and what was unique about this latest one.
The camp first grew out of the G8 protests in 2005, where a kind of eco-camp was set up as a base for all of the different protesters who were coming from all over the world and converging on Gleneagles in Scotland, the idea being it was a completely sustainable, non-hierarchically run camp. And then the idea came, well, we did this for this protest, why don't we do this specifically for environmental protests? And so the first specifically Camp for Climate Action happened the following year, in 2006, at a very large coal power station called Drax in Yorkshire. Then in 2007 there was the camp at Heathrow, and then 2008 we just had the camp at King's North Power Station in southern England.
And how did the King's North camp compare to the other camps?
Well, it was bigger, which is always a good sign. All these camps have been different in different ways, and the Heathrow one, a lot of it was about the kind of massive global media attention that got because we were targeting the world's biggest international airport, whereas this year it was much more a kind of UK-focused action around whether or not Britain goes ahead with a new generation of coal power stations. The power station they're proposing to build in Kent would be the first one for 30 years in the UK. It would essentially be saying, okay, we're going to go back to coal, even though we know how ridiculously polluting it is, even though we know it's the dirtiest fuel, it's time for more coal, hooray. But in terms of the camp itself, I guess the major difference was the extraordinary police crackdown that happened on the camp. But the fact that, despite all of that, thousands of people still came was incredibly exciting and inspiring.
In the lead up to the camp, was it expected that the police would become such a strong presence, or did that come as a bit of a shock?
It was a huge shock to all of us. In previous years, obviously there's been a lot of police interest in what we're doing, but nothing on the scale of what we've seen this year. So it was a huge shock to everyone involved to suddenly have thousands of police officers raiding the camp, confiscating vast amounts of people's equipment. It was sort of a very strange situation where throughout the whole week, there was only one occasion on which the police actually came onto the site after we'd properly set it up. The rest of the time, we had the place to ourselves, and we're running it ourselves, and it was completely peaceful, safe and happy. And all the sort of stuff that was happening around the edges was the police trying to get onto the site and often being very violent and just sort of attacking people for no reason. And, yes, flying police helicopters over the site at 2 a.m, keeping everybody awake.
I heard Wagner was played by the police.
We had several people reporting it, that there were police vehicles driving around in the middle of the night, blasting Wagner out the speakers. that was one of the sort of less confirmed things, but there were some things that definitely happened, like the levels of the things they confiscated, claiming that they could be used for criminal damage. You know, marker pens, children's crayons, they took a clown costume, they took a board game called the War on Terror board game, which is like a sort of comedy board game, because it included a balaclava as one of the comedy props. They confiscated, you know, a pensioner's walking stick. It was just absolutely bizarre. And they also took a lot of the safety equipment that we needed. And essentially it was attempting to get us riled, trying to make us fight back against the police. But what was incredibly inspiring was that despite all this over-the-top provocation, despite the fact that every person arriving on the site had to be searched for 2 hours before they were allowed on, nobody retaliated against the police in a violent way. And we found out that the government had actually been directly paying for 90% of this policing of the event. So, you know, a lot of it was coming from the very top. I mean, are we such an embarrassment or a threat to them and their policies that they need this level, this extraordinary level of crackdown in order to control us and to silence us? And, you know, there were times when it was frightening and there were times when it was very frustrating, but it was also a sense of, hang on, we must be doing something right here, you know, to provoke this level of response.
This recent acquittal of the Greenpeace activist who did an action there earlier in the year at the same place, what sort of impact do you think that's going to have on climate campaigning and coal campaigning in the UK and, I guess, internationally as well?
It was a huge boost. We were all so excited. We were really excited and inspired by what they did. And the fact that, for the first time, a UK jury agreed that climate change was a serious enough reason to acquit people of criminal damage, that has huge implications. And firstly, it's incredibly embarrassing for the government and the power companies, because they've essentially, you know, been told that the emissions from that power station are, you know, borderline illegal. You know, that's one interpretation that we'd certainly like to push. But also, it's making very clear that this form of peaceful direct action is a completely legitimate way of challenging the madness of fossil fuels and the madness of the idea of, you know, endless economic growth on a finite planet, and these really important messages need to get out there, that direct action of this kind is a completely legitimate way of doing it, and that the British public understand that. that if you take 12 people and sit them in a room and give them all the evidence and the information, they agree with us. So that's quite a powerful thing to be able to say.
And do you feel the camp was successful in terms of getting across your message of resistance to continued investment in coal?
Well, through a variety of different channels, yeah. I mean, we did become a big media story. I mean, unfortunately, at the beginning of the week, it was a media story about the police coming down on us really hard. But what that did is it then pushed us up to the news agenda so that when the day of action came, it was definitely all about coal and all about climate change. And just the fact that we were doing it, the fact that people were prepared to go and put their bodies in the way and to knowingly break the law because they felt so strongly about something, it sends such a powerful message that so much of the media debate was about coal. And we were a really important part of that. So in terms of public debate and public awareness, definitely we were successful. But also, I think it was really successful in terms of the people who came to the camp and what's happening on the ground, the people who are coming, getting educated, getting knowledgeable, getting inspired and being prepared, saying, this is a huge issue and we're going to take real action on it. And what was so incredible was that they knew exactly what we were doing. They spent millions on a massive policing operation. They had a whole massive new electric fence around the power station. Despite all of that, despite us being completely open about what we were doing, we still got people over the fences into the station. We still got people on the river right up to the jetty, disrupting the workings of the station. They had to shut down the water inlet. And to be honest, beforehand, we were a bit like, no, we're getting near that place. Thousands of police. They know where we are. They know where we're going. And yet we did. I think it was really inspiring for so many people involved for the first time just to see how powerful we can be when we really decide to do something and when we're all united and when we know it's important. And all these big, scary institutions that are there to stop us actually can't stop us when we're doing the right thing. And I think that bodes really, really well for future actions as well.
And that was the Third Degree's Libby King speaking with serial climate camper Steve Milligan.
And now to this week's burning issue, and this week we're looking at ethical investments. This is following on from a Corporate Watch report that has found that only 2 out of all so-called ethical investment funds do not invest in uranium mining. So if uranium mining is considered green and ethical, what other industries are being invested in? Like many people, the Third Degree's James Hitchcock didn't really know much about the details of his own fund, so he decided to call them and ask them how his super is being invested. He spoke with David St. John, Chief Investment Officer for UniSuper.
David, I currently have a standard account. Are there any restrictions for what kind of investments are made under this account?
No, James, there's not any specific restrictions that can be made within our mainstream investment products, although, of course, the fund can only invest in lawful activities.
Mm.
And the reason we don't restrict investments in the mainstream products is that under the Superannuation Industry Supervision Act, 1993, we're required to act in our members' best interests, and that's interpreted by law as being their best financial interests. So we have a very strict fiduciary duty to deliver the best possible retirement savings to our members. We do, though, expect our investment managers to take non-financial considerations into account. So, for example, non-financial considerations can include environmental, social and governance factors, which can, of course, impact share price. And another point, I guess, I'd make is that we also take an active ownership role. We vote all our proxies. We engage with companies in order to drive continuous improvement in corporate performance and behaviour. And the last observation I'd make is, of course, that we offer 2 socially responsible investment products that have been designed for those members who have particular concerns about investing in the more controversial industries such as tobacco, alcohol, uranium, weapons manufacture and so forth.
You mentioned the socially responsible investment option. Could you explain how this differs from the standard account you offer?
Yeah, sure. The mainstream investment options focus predominantly on financial performance. In contrast, our SRI options focus on satisfying member investment needs as well as their values in respect to environmental, social and governance factors. So they seek to ensure the best environmental and social practices occur. So the SRI portfolios are skewed to those companies exhibiting the best environmental, social and governance practices and away from things like tobacco, alcohol, uranium and weapons manufacture. We provide these 2 SRI options because we care about our members' investment needs and we seek to provide them with options that are aligned to their personal values.
One of the other ways you, deal with socially responsible in investments is by negatively screening out companies who receive greater than 10% of their revenue from activities such as tobacco and uranium mining, as you mentioned. Can you explain how you reach this figure of 10%?
Well, the exact screen tends to vary across our managers, but the 10% maximum revenue exposure threshold is reasonably common in the industry. It's a recognised standard, so it's been set at 10% or thereabouts to manage unintentional exposure to controversial industries. It's the level at which activity is not considered to be a core business. So the threshold is seeking to strike a balance between meeting members' needs and ensuring that the investment universe is not unduly constrained. It should also be remembered that we're investing in large multinational companies, or often we're investing in those companies, and they themselves have subsidiary companies, and often the financial arrangements are quite complex. So if the threshold is set too low or at zero, it can be very difficult to monitor and enforce as well. But that's not to say that the managers don't examine companies with less than 10% revenue exposure or below threshold exposure, because they do look at those companies to see whether or not those companies are going to expand their operations. And if they are going to expand their operations, then the managers won't invest.
The figure of 10% revenue allows for investments in two of the biggest resource companies, BHP Billiton and Rio Tinto, who own Olympic Dam and Ranger Mine in the Northern Territory, respectively. Do you think many of the customers who choose the socially responsible option realise that they'll be investing in these two options when they sign up?
We have comprehensive member education material that is on our website, and I would encourage our members to look at particularly our Investing for the Future documentation. It fully explains the products, and it should be self-evident that there is that type of exposure within the products because of the best of sector approach that we employ within the two options.
One of the things the socially responsible option doesn't, I guess, specifically negatively screen out is greenhouse polluting activities, which I guess is fairly common among all ethical and socially responsible type of investment options. Do you think, as consumers, I guess, becoming increasingly more concerned about greenhouse pollution, do you think this is something, an activity that should be screened out in the future?
Well, certainly no one can ignore climate change and the impact it may have on the future, but we sort of don't see it as purely as an environmental issue. We also see it as a key business driver. So as a consequence, carbon risks and opportunities need to be assessed across the entire portfolio, not just the SRI options. So this is a particular issue that we're paying very close attention to, and so are our managers. But screening out the emission-intensive industries, we don't think will provide the best outcome for members, and it certainly won't drive change, because as funds, we take a very active approach. We vote our proxies, we engage with the companies to drive the improved corporate performance and behaviour. And if you're not a shareholder, then your ability to influence corporate behaviour is much more constrained. So it's for that reason that negative screening is not considered to be best practice. It's really a last resort.
And that was The Third Degree's James Hitchcock talking with David St. John, Chief Investment Officer for UniSuper. And there's obviously a couple of issues coming out of that. First of all, the question of whether there's enough disclosure about the sorts of things that ethical investment funds are investing in. David also stated that negatively screening or filtering out carbon-intensive industries is not a way to drive change. He suggests that the best option is to be a shareholder in these companies, and he claims that UniSuper attend all the corporate meetings and are active in that manner. So the question is, can superannuation basically be used to drive positive change?
Yeah, so it is quite difficult to know, and that's why we're asking whether you can call up your super fund and ask them exactly where your funds are being invested, and then email us the answer at thethirddegree@2ser.com, and that's third with the number 3.
And on now to Brendan Nelson, called a leadership spill of the Liberal Party this week and lost to Malcolm Turnbull. If he had won, Nelson was planning to take a tough stance against Labor's emissions trading scheme, putting Australia first by trying to delay it. He was criticised for taking another populist position, yet a survey released last week suggests that delaying action on climate change isn't popular with Australians. The study from the Centre for the Study of Choice at the University of Technology Sydney found a large majority of Australians believe action needs to be taken soon, irrespective of the cost. The Third Degree's Andy Small spoke with Jordan Louvier, Executive Director of the Research Centre at UTS, about the survey's political implications.
By and large, it looks like virtually all Australians are in favour of an emissions. I shouldn't say all, a large proportion of Australians are favor of an emissions trading program. 84% of them believe that global warming is happening. A large majority, about 82%, rejects the idea of not adopting a plan to reduce greenhouse gases. And a large proportion, this is sort of the surprising thing, believes that Australia should go ahead and cut its greenhouse gases regardless of what others do.
So do you think it shows that you know, Australians are making up their own mind on these issues independent of what politicians are telling them?
Well, that's one interpretation. That's a different proportion than the Americans from memory. Now, on the other hand, the public, the sample rather that we surveyed actually doesn't feel very knowledgeable. Only about 12.5% indicated that they thought they knew a lot about global warming. 60% said they thought they knew a moderate amount, and 26% said they knew little, with 1% suggesting they knew absolutely nothing.
Do you know if there have been similar studies to the one that you did conducted in other countries to gauge public support?
No, not that we're aware of, and the reason why is what we're focusing on in this study is the trade-offs that people would make between various elements of an emissions trading plan, rather than looking at a specific plan.
Okay.
So Garnaut has recommended a number of things that be taken into account with respect to an emissions plan. The government has mooted one particular plan, and so we extracted out from the Garnaut report five key elements that seem to span most of the discussion in the report.
One of the questions you asked your 768 respondents was whether 20% of money raised through a greenhouse gas reduction scheme should be invested in research and development.
That's correct. That's one of the other elements in the plan.
Yes, and I noted that 58% of respondents answered in the affirmative. But
right.
Where did this 20% figure come from?
We looked at a number of suggestions that have been made around not only Australia but other countries. Richard Carson is actually much more up on this than I am.
Okay.
And the figures between about 10 and 25% have been bandied around as to reinvesting in R&D, particularly on energy savings and related transport reductions.
Now, I understand the results were collected using respondents who were sourced via the internet. Do you think that this might have had a limiting effect on the demographics?
A small one. We actually used the Pure Profile Australia-wide panel. It consists of around 300,000 households, sampled to be as representative as possible of all Australians. Now, that panel is known to be slightly higher in income, slightly younger in age. But it's worth noting that the Galaxy poll uses this panel as well, and no one has been more accurate at predicting polling outcomes for elections than the Galaxy poll over the last several years.
All right, I'll just ask you one final question. What the respondents did show is that a majority of people who answered believe that climate change is happening, it's serious, and action should be taken. Do you think that these findings send a clear message to policymakers, or do you even agree with my reading of the survey?
Oh, I agree with your reading of the survey, and I think it does send a good message to politicians.
And that was Andy Small talking to Jordan Louvier from the UTS Centre for the Study of Choice about public support for climate change policy. And don't forget to tune in next week, same time, 9 o'clock on 2SER. James and Libby will be hosting next week. And also don't forget to check out our website at 2SER, and that's under the third degree.
And don't forget that we've asked you to call up your super fund and ask them exactly where your funds are being invested, and to then let us know. And that's at the third degree at 2SER.com.
So, yeah, we'll see you next time.